Hello and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 30th of June 2013. My name's T.R.P. Watson, and this week I'm joined by Phil from the West End Whingers, Nick from Partially Obstructed View, and Gareth James. We're now going to talk about Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, which is on at the Theatre or Drury Lane. It's written by David Gregg with music and lyrics by Mark Shaman and Scott Whitman. It's based on Roald Dahl's 1964 novel and is directed by Sam Mendes. It stars Douglas Hodge as Willy Wonka and Nigel Planer as Grandpa Joe. I mention Nigel Planer principally because he seems to have been in the opening cast of three long-running West End shows, Chicago, Wicked, and We Will Rock You. So he's got a bit of a history in the West End, which is I find fascinating.
I think he was in Avicii as well.
Yes, I mean, he was. I know he was an understudy to David Essex in Evita, the original cast of Evita, wasn't he? This musical does include one Anthony Newley, Leslie Brooker's song from the 1971 film, which many people think of as a sort of the classic rendition of the story. That song is a Pure Imagination, which I think is used in the second act. I was slightly disappointed when I heard that this was the only song, but then again, there are really only three songs that you remember from that film, I think. There's obviously Pure Imagination, there's The Candyman, we found a rather awful rendition of The Candyman by Anthony Newley recently, and of course there is all the Oompa Loompa choruses that stick in the mind. Phil, what did you think about this play, and tell me more about it?
Well, one of the problems I had was the songs, actually, especially because I was a huge fan of Hairspray. I found them just completely unmemorable. And Pure Imagination, obviously we know Pure Imagination, so it's whether it's a great song or not, it sticks in your memory, perhaps because you've heard it so many times. But they use that right at the end, and it sort of stands out in a way, because you come out humming that. And actually, I came out humming The Candyman and thinking, what if they used Pure Imagination, why didn't they use that? Because it's the only really memorable song in the show. The book for me as well, I didn't find very funny. I mean, the woman next to me was roaring with laughter at things which I wouldn't even say were gags, but they were funny moments. But it didn't really make me laugh at all, which I was surprised at, actually, because I was expecting it to be quite a lot of fun. I did go with quite high expectations. There is definitely, I think, still a problem with the first act. I'd heard this beforehand, but I thought that would have been sorted out. And I think that's probably to do with the structure of the story in itself. It's very sort of Gray and Dickensian, and sort of it's the build-up to going to the chocolate factory itself, which happens right at the end of Act One, which is, you can understand them breaking there, and it's very sort of teasing as Willy Wonka sort of says, why don't you come inside or something like that, and then it just goes into blackout. So you come back really gagging for the second act, where most of the real spectacle is. I mean, there's no doubt about it. It's certainly a spectacle. You can see the money up on stage. There's some very good effects. There's one particularly good one, which I have no idea how they did it. Well, I might have a vague idea how they did it, but I couldn't explain it completely right at the end. It's a very, very colourful second act, which is obviously a deliberate contrast to sort of the very grey first act. But I think the first act is slightly bound by the nature of the piece, having the four grandparents, Charlie's four grandparents, in bed pretty much throughout. They've tried to kind of choreograph them slightly, which is sort of clever. But you still feel you're kind of stuck with that build-up, and the wait for Willy is really far too long. And Douglas Hodge is introduced in a way in the first act slightly, rather strangely, I think, just to sort of give him perhaps a little bit more to do, which I didn't really kind of get why they'd done that. And having said that, the Oompa Loompas are brilliantly done. There are some very colourful, spectacular things done in the second act, particularly in sort of each violent death to each child. But there's also a feeling of repetition, which is due to, I think, the nature of the story in itself, of the deaths coming one after the other, that the narrative is kind of quite stuck by the story itself. And in the first act as well, the best bit really is when they're watching, and it's sort of on a giant TV screen, the four other willing ticket holders get their tickets, the four awful children. The first one of those, the German one, is very good, and actually that number is good. But the other three didn't really work for me, and actually I really couldn't make out the lyrics of... Well, I couldn't make out any of the lyrics of one of them at all, which was a huge problem. And I don't think it's where we were sitting, or because it was a preview, because it was a quite late preview, and I believe the show had already been fixed by then. But, you know, you couldn't hear the lyrics, and you couldn't hear the lyrics in other parts of the show as well, particularly when the children were singing, which is quite unusual, because usually kids in shows these days are so brilliant, particularly in, say, Matilda, that I thought, they need to sort this out.
Nick, what did you think about this?
I will say certainly that the thing is, I mean, I enjoyed the new songs, but I agree they're not at all memorable. I kind of sat there thinking, you know, I actually might end up downloading these when they become available. So I didn't hate them, but they certainly didn't have, especially when you contrast them to Pure Imagination, which is, you know, a well-loved song that everybody's been hearing for decades. So there's no chance of you coming out humming anything else, because they really, and I really like, I'm a big fan of their work on Hairspray and Catch Me If You Can. I really liked, it's a bit of a, it feels like a bit of a variation in style from what they did in those two shows, which had kind of a fairly similar sound to each other, which, I mean, is good, but at the same time doesn't quite work in coming up with as effective, as memorable songs. But I think they're enjoyable. I agree. I think that a lot of shows I have a problem with the sound balance. I mean, it gets to the stage nowadays where I'll actually compliment the sound balance if it's any good, and that really shouldn't be the case. It should be the default. So yeah, I mean, the sound balance isn't great, but it is. I mean, it's always going to have the elephant in the room now, which is Matilda. And it isn't. I mean, it's not quite as effective as Matilda, but it's doing something very different. Now, it's not quite funny enough, and it's not, for me, it's not quite kind of got that spark of darkness that Matilda managed to put in. The one bit that really, for me, felt quite spectacularly dark and creepy, kind of funny, is the conclusion to the Mike TV storyline. And his mother, who's played by Iris Roberts, I think the actress's name is. The way that character's built up is really quite a disturbed character. And the way that story concludes is, I was really impressed with how dark that came across. Yeah, I think it is. I mean, it is more of a spectacle. You do come out humming the sets, as I think people have said. But the other thing for me about the sets, which is a problem, is that they push a lot of the action downstage. And, I mean, I was in the cheap seats, and pretty much for the entire balcony at the Drury Lane, the downstage area is a bit of a blind spot. So, for me, I mean, the best bits really were those bits with the live TV broadcast, simply because we could see all of it, every little nuance we could get, because it's staged kind of in a separate part. It's staged a bit more upstage, and you can see all of it. So it is a disappointment in that there's a huge chunk of that auditorium where the downstage area is a problem, and I think because the sets are taking up a huge amount of space and they're not necessarily always being interacted with, so actually they're doing their thing upstage, and then you've got the people downstage doing whatever it is they're doing that I couldn't always see. It is a mixed bag. It was a lot better than I was expecting, to be honest, because I came in kind of expecting not to like it, because I think I liked Matilda so much. I was kind of expecting disappointment. So maybe that's the key, is to not go in expecting too much. And I'm not a huge fan of Douglas Hodge in general, so I never really felt like I clicked with the way he was portraying Willy Wonka. I was never quite sure what his interpretation was meant to be, just how kind of creepy he was trying to go for or not. I would disagree about including him in the first act. I actually liked how that worked. I don't think I've seen any other. I mean, I don't remember particularly the original book, but I don't remember any other version of it where it's been suggested quite so heavily that it's that Willy Wonka's kind of working undercover to ensure that Charlie gets his golden ticket, which is kind of what's heavily implied here. Yeah, I think it's a satisfying show. It's not the greatest show it could have been, and yeah, it's not as funny as it could have been, but I think it was better than I was expecting. It's worth a look. It's an entertaining evening. It's flawed, but it works on a lot of levels.
I think the thing that really was missing for me was magic. I mean, apart from the tricks, obviously, that I didn't engage with it properly. And I don't really know why that was. And I do like Douglas Hodge a lot. I think he's terrific. And I was slightly disappointed. I think he's good in some ways as Wonka. He's got a kind of quite a good mix of charming and sort of mystery about him. But it still didn't quite work for me, and I'm not quite sure why.
I will say that, like, more than most people, I mean, because I've heard other people apart from yourself say about the first act, and it is the story rather than the production, the way it's structured, and the first act is obviously the grey, everything building up. I did actually quite enjoy that first act, and I mean, speaking of getting involved in it, I actually found that when Charlie eventually gets his golden ticket, I found that particularly moving. I think the person I went with was he was like, why? I mean, it was inevitable that it was going to happen, but I mean, that's not really the point. I thought the way, given that his story is kind of this so over-the-top kind of Dickensian parody of poverty, I found it quite surprisingly effective.
Can I just ask about the... Because Phil said the deaths of the children. Obviously, knowing the book, that isn't quite right. I mean, are we led to think that they all meet grisly ends? Or
well, maybe deaths isn't the right word. They're fates, perhaps.
Yes.
I mean, one of those, actually, the video one, is an extraordinary piece of stagecraft. I will say that it's technically you do come out thinking, how quite did they do that without giving too much away? Because I think it would be a shame to spoil it. Is that pre-recorded? Is it being done live? The way that they interact with the video, and the final part of that is a very nice touch when he's shrunken. I don't know the story well enough to remember if he ends up shrunken. Is that a change to the...
No, he ends up shrunken, yes.
That's okay. That's what I remember as well. I think, yeah. That is definitely one where he definitely doesn't die, but it doesn't really end up that well for him either.
Yeah.
But with the others, I mean, actually, again, this was something going in that we were having a argument about with the person I went with. He was quite determined that they don't die and you see them at the end being fine. I definitely didn't spot any kind of indication at the end going, yes, they're definitely fine. It is, for me, it was left up in the air. There's definitely indications for some of them that it's like, oh, he's going to die. Oh, what's going to happen? He's going to be turned into whatever sweet it is they're making at the time. It's never explicitly said that, yes, that's what happened. The child died at the end. But it, with the exception of Mike, where he is at least alive at the end, it's never made explicit the other way either, that they're fine. It is open to interpretation, I think. I mean, I could easily take it as being that kind of darker side of, they did just kill the kids.
In the book, they all live, but they are very much not fine. You know, it is fairly gruesome, the things
they're
that happen
punished,
to them.
Perhaps we should say.
We're now going to talk about The Night Alive at the Donmar Warehouse. This is written and directed by Connor McPherson and concerns Tommy, who rents a room in his uncle Morris's Dublin house. He's divorced from his wife, he's avoiding his children. We get a sense that he's been brought low by the Irish economic crisis. Well, you know, the housing, all that housing bust that they have. He's getting by now doing odd jobs together with his rather slow-witted friend called Doc. And the play really begins when he comes to the aid of a young woman called Amy, who's quite a lot more troubled than than you first think, especially when her boyfriend, or possibly her pimp, comes onto the scene. He's called Kenneth. This play was well acted, but I did kind of think it was Conor McPherson by numbers. It is a decent enough story, but I didn't feel that there was any sort of magical mystery. I was very disappointed by his previous play, the National Theatre. They did The Veil in 2011, and I was very disappointed by that. So, but it wasn't as bad as that, or as messy as that. But it certainly wasn't as good as his previous one, the National, which was The Seafarer, which I thought was very good. And it actually shares two of the actors from this. The actors in this are Tommy is played by Kieran Hines, Doc played by Michael McElhattan, Morris the old man who Tommy's landlord is played by Jim Norton, and the young woman Amy is played by Keelan Dunn. Although it's not exactly spelt like that, and her boyfriend Kenneth is Brian Gleeson. I mean, one of the problems I had with this play was that it's kind of set. It feels rural when you first do it. It feels as if it's a house in a small town, but out on the outskirts, and then you're suddenly told, no, we're in the middle of Dublin, or we're sort of in a what would have to be a fairly prosperous suburb, given that. He lives in a sort of a big house or a big slightly run down house. It would be quite a decent area of Dublin, but you don't feel that it's sort of in any way built up, or that they have neighbours or anything like that. You know, people come and go and wander in and out. So I think that might have been one of its problems. We are set always in this single room with a very, very basic kitchen at one end, a toilet which is locked off by a partition, and a couple of beds and a table. It's very, very run down feel to it, but I wasn't entirely happy with this play, even though it was well acted and it told a decent enough and interesting enough story. I just didn't think it sort of zinged to me, and I think that's one of its problems for me. Nick, what did you think about this?
I was much more positive about this than you were, obviously. And I actually, it's funny. I mean, I really didn't have the issue you were just describing about the location. I really felt, especially kind of if there's a midpoint scene that kind of takes place quite late at night, I really felt like this was people sort of staying up while everyone around them was sleeping. I mean, they're kind of, there is an isolation, but it never felt to me that it was geographical. It did feel like this was the suburbs and everyone else had gone to bed. So I certainly disagree with that. I mean, that was actually one of my highlights, was how much I felt like we were sort of eavesdropping on these people's kind of staying up late and kind of getting on with what they were doing while they should have gone to bed. Oh, actually, in some cases, did go to bed hours ago and have been woken up in the middle of the night. Yeah, I generally thought this was very good. It doesn't kind of have that sort of ghost story feel to it that McPherson normally has. That's true. But I mean, it certainly is a hell of a lot better than The Veil. No, I thought very good performances. I was very interested in the kind of the dignity that Kieran Hines brings to this character, who's kind of been brought down to quite a much lower point than he thought he would ever have to. I mean, there's something quite impressive about feeling like he's quite a dignified character when he's going around eating dog biscuits. So I thought it was very impressive. I also really liked Brian Gleeson, who plays the boyfriend and or pimp. There's a really nice balance of he turns up and he's kind of a comical, shambolic character, but at the same time, right from the start, he's really quite threatening. And you kind of feel this discomfort with him being around. So I think that's another very, very good performance. But generally, no, I enjoyed it. I thought it's a strange kind of optimism to it in parts. Sort of central character learns to learns how to live with the situation he's in at the moment and the people he's with at the moment, and kind of not to be careful what he wishes for this beautiful woman he's kind of got a crush on that doesn't necessarily bring good things when she does turn up in his house. So no, I was a lot more positive about it. I mean, my issues with it occasionally are with the tone of it. It's a bit samey, and I think I always have an issue with writers directing their own work. I think unless it's somebody like Anthony Nielsen, who's kind of writing it in the course of rehearsals and there's no other way to do it, I think if it is scripted, I like to see a director go in there and have another perspective on there, simply because sometimes you do get this some of the kind of inherent problems with it, which in this case it does have quite a lot of endings. It kind of feels like it's going to end and then it goes on for another scene, and then it goes on for another scene. And I think maybe an external director could have done something about the pacing of it a bit. But apart from that, I was generally pretty pleased with this.
We're now going to talk about Fences at the Duchess Theatre. This is the 1987 play by August Wilson. It's the sixth in his in August Wilson's 10-part Pittsburgh cycle. The sixth, as in big, he does a play reflecting the African American experience in each decade of the 20th century. So he didn't actually write this sixth. I think this is the third he actually wrote in this decalogy, but it is the sixth in the place because it's set in the 1950s. This production stars Lenny Henry, Tanya Moody, Colin McFarlane, Peter Bencole, Ashley Zangaza, and Akko Mitchell. It's directed by Paulette Randall, and the designer is Libby Wilson. Gareth, tell us more about this play.
Well, the play revolves around Troy, who's a sort of 50-something, very dominant, very charismatic man. He's father, brother, and husband, and friend. From the backstory, we know he was in prison for accidental murder that happened during a robbery. We also know that he was good enough to be a baseball player, but because of the odds were loaded quite heavily against black players at the time, he failed to make a career out of that. And the third thing we learn from the backstory is that his brother comes back from the Korean War very disturbed, and Troy uses his compensation money to buy a home. And sitting on this little stage in this little theatre, we have an enormous two-story house with a porch, and the whole play takes place in the porch and in the yard, as the Americans call it, of this very, very realistic Pittsburgh home. And what plays out really is that, I mean, he's really hurts his son, and falls out with his son, because he prevents him from pursuing his own baseball ambitions because of what's happened to him. He's actually unfaithful to his wife, Rose, who is a real treasure. He makes a career as a garbage man, and because he's quite assertive, he actually manages to get them to move him from the menial tasks into driving, which his best friend, Jim, doesn't get to do. And really, that's it. It's a kind of, you know, it's a kind of family saga, really, you know, of these black Americans and their experiences. I personally, even though I've seen, I think, three or four other August Wilson plays, I personally don't think it's a great play. He's often compared with Arthur Miller. The problem for me is that he overwrites and throws in the kitchen sink, really. And that, to me, makes him not as good a playwright as Miller, even though I think his storylines and dialogue are interesting. So I think it's an interesting enough family drama, but for me, it doesn't really go anywhere. And I don't think it's a great play. And having said that, it is a great production. And the reason you have to go and see this, I think, is that it's got a superb set of performances. And that not just from Lenny Henry, who's obviously starring in it, but from other members of the cast as well. And the friend Bono is played by an actor called Colin McFarlane, who is really good. And he's got a particularly good chemistry with Lenny Henry. You know, you really feel this is a strong friendship. Tanya Moody, who you mentioned, is just wonderful, is his very put-upon wife. And again, she plays off Lenny Henry quite brilliantly. And there's another brilliant performance in it from Ashley Zangaza, who is terrific as the son, Corey. I mean, we've seen him in smaller parts in King Lear and I think Othello at the Donmar, but he won the Ian Charleston Award for an out-of-town production, I think, of Macbeth. But he really, really is one to watch. And as for Lenny Henry, I mean, even though he's twice the age of of Daniel Radcliffe, there is a kind of parallel here because we've got another man who's making a second career. This is his third stage performance. And he has chosen very bravely because his first was Othello. His second was also Shakespeare, with Comedy of Errors. And here's, you know, a big, big role in a big American drama. And you can see the trajectory. I mean, he really has grown as an actor. I mean, when he did Othello, he had great presence and he had this beautiful booming baritone voice, but you can kind of see the joins in an acting sense. And here now, I mean, he is, I mean, you don't see the acting. I mean, really is, he completely inhabits this character. And it's a very, very impressive and a very, very tiring performance. I mean, it's very difficult to take your eyes off him. Very, very good indeed. So I think it's, I mean, it's a great production. It's absolutely worth seeing for these performances and very, very welcome in the West End. Very brave bit of summer programming for me, bringing this play into the West End. I really hope it finds its audience. Certainly the audience on the night I went last week was a great mixed audience. And, you know, you could tell that lots of these people were probably coming new to the theatre. And I'm sure, you know, Lenny Henry's drawn them in. But like Daniel Radcliffe, this isn't a star turn. This is a great piece of ensemble acting. And I suspect benefits from the fact they've been on the road for 3 months, because they started in Bath and they've done a little tour. And I think, you know, even though I saw a late preview, this was no preview. This was a fully formed and excellent production, which got a standing ovation. So to be recommended for me.
Yeah, I saw it when it was at Richmond, and it was certainly very, very well put together then. And Lenny Henry is, of course, an interesting actor. I mean, although this is his sort of only his third stage piece, he has done sort of serious drama before. I remember him from a series called Hope and Glory on the television, where he played a headmaster and got a lot of plaudits for that, you know, for going serious like that. And there are one or two other things that, you know, you'd like to see of Lenny Henry's work, previous work. There was a play called Coast to Coast, which was quite good fun on television. And of course, there's an early Richard Curtis called Bernard and the Genie, which is sadly is only available by a rather dodgy on a rather dodgy looking DVD, which doesn't look official at all. But I mean, yeah, as you say, the rest of the cast are very good. I mean, I always like to see Colin McFarlane and Tanya Moody, and Ashley Zengaza is. You mentioned before we started recording that there seems to have been a production we hadn't really heard of this play done, where Adrian Lester played the same role, and maybe there are sort of parallels with that.
I did some Googling and came across, I think it was the Bristol University database, which had a 1994 production of the Garrick Theatre. And I can't remember the rest of the cast, because the one thing that caught my eye was Adrian Lester. And given it's 20 years ago, he must have been playing Corey, I would think. They must have been playing the same role. So if that's the case, then that augurs very well for Ashley Zengaza, if he's following in Adrian Lester's boots. So maybe in 20 years we'll be seeing his Othello. Wouldn't that be good?
We're now going to talk about Hard Feelings at the Finborough Theatre. This is Doug Lucy's 1982 play, first staged at the Oxford Playhouse before transferring into the Bush in 1983, and where it was directed by Mike Bradwell. It was later broadcast as a play for the Today, and oddly enough, I remember 30 years ago seeing this. There's a particular line, which I don't think I can mention because it's rather late in the play, which sort of suddenly took me back 30 years when I was watching this play, which is always a rather disturbing feeling. We are in Thatcher's Britain in 1981 in Brixton. There are riots on the streets, and we're set in a house which is owned by the parents of an Oxford University graduate called Viv. She is living there with her friend Jane, who is very serious and studious and studying law, as well as Baz, a sort of working-class Yorkshire boy who she seems to almost... Well, there's a slight feeling he's a bit of a pet. He always goes along with her. And she's joined up with a couple of rather empty, shallow friends, Annie and Rusty. They always want to go out to parties, they're having sex with everybody, they scrounge off benefits or scrounge off other people. They're actually quite of quite well-off parents, as is Viv, and they really just taking advantage and being apathetic and shallow, and they just sort of live this rather empty lives, ignoring what's outside. I mean, especially when there is almost a riot on the doorstep, and we see one scene where Viv is sitting in the flat holding a knife, waiting for somebody to burst in. But there are tensions between Viv and Jane, possibly because this Jane is sort of this studious person. She's no longer part of this rather empty clique. She's trying to become a lawyer. Her boyfriend, who is a sort of radical freelance journalist who's is sort of very left-wing, he sounds these days like a bit of a prig, but I think in the original play, perhaps he was more kind of the voice of left-wing reason and that kind of speaking out against all the depredations of Thatcher. I mean, Thatcher was on the way out in 1981 when this play was conceived, and possibly even into 1982, but because of things like the Falklands War and other pieces, she sort of won back the public's affection and was able to get re-elected. But when this is set, it really felt as if she was on the way out and she'd got everything wrong and was being utterly disastrous for the country, and we can discuss at length whether or not that was true. I really like this play. We have Isabella Loughlin playing Viv, Zora Bishop playing Jane, Baz's Nick Blakely, Annie and Rusty are played by Margaret Clooney and Jesse Fox, and Callum Turner plays the rather priggish Tone. The fascinating thing about this is it felt for me very up to date. It felt as if this is what youth are like now, and there was perhaps a slight feeling that it was almost young people today playing dress up. I mean, if you didn't know this was written 30 years ago, then you might think, well, yeah, yes, you know, it's a play about the youth of today, but for some reason they set it in 1981. But it's a very good production. This is directed by James Hillier, and it's produced by the Defibrillator Company. It's their third production. They did a very good production of Blue Surge at the Finborough in 2011, which I was extremely impressed by. And last year, of course, they did the Hotel Plays, where on the same situated suite on three floors of a hotel, they did three different short Tennessee Williams plays, and that was very, very well done, and probably not as well frequented as it might have been, although I think every night was, I think it was sold out, but they could only fit less than 20 people into each room, so it was a bit difficult to really think it's a sort of a financial success, but I think it was certainly an artistic. Gareth, what did you think about Hard Feelings?
Well, I enjoyed it very much, and I was really glad I went to see it. I saw the original production of The Bush back in 1983, when the part of Viv, I think, was played by Frances Barber. That tells you how long ago that was then, as Viv is a 20-something. And I've really liked Doug Lucy, the playwright. You know, he wrote about 15 plays in the 80s, 90s, and into the noughties. And, you know, he was getting plays produced as places like The Bush and The Tricycle and Hampstead and The Lyric and Hammersmith and The Royal Court, and then he had one at the RSC. And I've always wondered why he stopped writing, because we don't seem to have had anything from him for about 10 or more years. And secondly, why he's never revived. So, you know, a revival of Doug Lucy play for me was a must. And I did enjoy it. And I'm with you there. I mean, what struck me most about it was that if you took away the clothes, if you took away the sort of decor of the room and the period references and the fact that, well, I'm not even sure you have to take away the fact that Brixton riots were going on, because there could be other riots last year as well. But if you take those things away, it could easily be a contemporary play. And at first, you know, my thinking was, well, nothing's changed then. But then I kind of thought, no, actually, no, it's not that. It's that we've gone full circle, that actually things did change, but we've gone back again. And I think these kind of attitudes, you know, the sort of there's no such thing as society as it's famous for, have kind of come back. I think that there was a period between then and now when actually, you know, I think things did change. But I think that's what it is. I think we've kind of gone full circle, and therefore it could easily be a play written now. Somebody said to me that they thought, how can you like a play with these horrible people? And I think that is a point. I mean, you know, they are very hard to like. But actually, I didn't think they were caricatures. I thought they were quite believable. And I felt that, I mean, I really hated them, and they made me angry. So that, you know, that does tell you that this was very believable, I think. The performance was very believable, and the writing was very believable. Because I really did, I was sitting in the front row of the Little Finborough, I really did want to get up and give them a slap, because I was really annoyed and angry about what they were doing and their attitudes. And indeed, with what the very compliant character of Baz, actually wanted to get up and shake him by the lapels and tell him to get some strength from somewhere. So I think it is a bit of a timeless piece. I think it does take a while to get into, because at the beginning it's a bit of a slow burn, I think, in at the beginning. But it did really grab me and really made me think about, you know, about what was going on here. I think the kind of central conceit, I think, is that Viv, you know, the rich girl, I mean, you either comply with her by joining her, which is what the two other rich kids do, you know, so they kind of have this social life and sex life with her, or indeed you actually just have a quiet life and kind of are compliant to her, which is what Baz and Jane do, until of course she crosses a line with Jane. And the character who comes in, the outsider, as it were, the left-wing journo, I think the great thing about him is that he does kind of bring in the home truths, really. He brings in the outside world and shows them, or tries to show them, what's happening outside, but they just don't care. And I think that's a very clever way of bringing this up, really. And I agree with you about Defibrillator. I've seen all three of these shows, and I enjoy Blue Surge. I really enjoy the Hotel plays, and I think this is a third example where they've collaborated with the Finborough again and done something very, very good indeed. And sitting there in Travis staging, with just sort of three rows either side of the set, I mean, you really are in the room, and it's a very intense and very effective kind of experience. Probably if I'd sort of lost myself even more in the play, I might well have got up and given them a slap. But no, it's got another week to run, I think, or as we speak, another week to run. And I wouldn't miss it. I think it's, you know, he's a playwright sadly neglected. And thank goodness we got the Finborough to bring us things like this. Very, very much recommended for me.
Yeah, I did at some stages think, what is exactly is Viv's deal? Why does she take against Jane? And, you know, you could sort of make up reasons afterwards. I don't know it's not explicit why she does. And in fact, she says, I don't want to rationalize it, why she suddenly stops liking Jane at all. But, you know, obviously you can sort of make the rationalization that the Jane is the kind of person that she should be and is easily capable of being. But she's going for this sort of easy, rather empty life instead, and you know, those are themes that are in the play. But I mean, this is fascinating, and as you say, Doug Lucy, yeah, I'd like to see a lot more of his. There's a play I saw of his, a short play that he did for Royal Court May Day Festival back in the early 90s, which I saw because I was trying to see all the other plays that they all the plays that they were doing at the time. I seem to see that one because they were all sort of done one after another, and you sort of couldn't come in and go out. I sort of ended up seeing that particular play, which is called Doing the Business, lots of times, and I really got to like Doug Lucy while watching that play. I saw it four or five times, I think. But I really got to like his way of writing, and I've always looked out for his plays, and as you say, they're not done enough.
My take on Viv, by the way, is that she's not very mature. She's got a very low emotional age. She's effectively behaving like a teenager. And that's the sort of thing that would happen. You know, what happens is this kind of, you know, this kind of teenage behavior. There's no reason why she turns against anybody, except she's a bit of a control freak and she's got a very low emotional age, in my opinion. So I kind of think he invented a character with low emotional intelligence before anybody wrote a book about emotional intelligence. But I'm with you on Doug Lucy. Can we have some more, please? I'd love to see Progress again. I'd like to see Fashion again. I mean, these are plays, these are 20, 30-year-old plays that really should be revived.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the as-yet-unnamed London Theatre Podcast page in Facebook. On the web, we are AYULTP.com, and the podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you. Goodbye.